Welcome to another exciting episode of the NIDS View, a weekly show of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies, where we are advancing peace, promoting stability, and helping you to think deterrence. Each week, we will discuss and analyze a recent topic and provide insight to how it affects our national deterrence. The view of the hosts and guests are their own. We hope you enjoy the show.
Welcome back to another exciting episode of the NIDS View. Welcome to 2025. Of course, we expect it to be a great year this year, both for the NIDS View and NIDS as an organization, and hopefully for you individual listeners as well. Now, today we've got a great discussion for you, but we also have a great guest who's joined us. I'm talking about Lieutenant General Mbom Chun, who, if you listen to NucleCast, he's been on that podcast a couple of times, but he's also a NIDS fellow, and he's joining us today. Now, General Chun, you've got a, for those who are listening and not watching, you're wearing a Star Trek shirt. Could you tell us Star Trek uniform? So, you know, we were curious when you had that, but then when you told us why, we were like, that is awesome. So can you tell us why you're wearing your Star Trek uniform today?
Well, actually, I'm wearing the captain's shirt here, but it's in reference to today's discussion, which is about should we go nuclear or not? And it references Star Trek Season 2, Episode 19. This is the episode where Captain Kirk and his crew land on a planet where two competing societies are rivals. And he finds the one side having flintlocks. And they find out that the Klingons have been supplying this technology, which disturbs the balance of that planet. And so Kirk must decide whether to provide flintlocks for his the peaceful side of the people. And of course, McCoy says, "Jim, you can't do that, you know, Starfleet regulations, blah, blah, blah." And then Spock goes, "Captain, according to this, I must, you know, agree with Dr. McCoy." But in the end, Captain Kirk decides to provide flintlocks to the other side to maintain the balance. And although it doesn't say it, I think he prays that it for the best, that it will create some sort of balance and that they will be able to figure out that escalation is not the answer. So today, I think we're talking about the same thing. I just wanted to make sure that this is something that all the Americans would think about when we're talking about should we or should we not allow the South Koreans their own nuclear weapons, because it's up to you. It's up to the United States to make that decision.
Yeah, that's sort of a great analogy. I'm glad you thought of it and decided to, you know, to bring that into the show. But, you know, there was an article in Foreign Affairs in the January-February 2025 edition of Foreign Affairs, and it's called "Why South Korea Should Go Nuclear: The Bomb is the Best Way to Contain the Threat from the North." And it's by Robert Kelly and Min-Young Kim, who I think they both teach in universities in South Korea. But Kelly is originally, you know, he's an American, and they make sort of a compelling argument in the article for why South Korea should, you know, get their own indigenous nuclear arsenal. They shouldn't ask for the return of, you know, American weapons. They shouldn't be a latent nuclear weapon state. They should have their own inherent nuclear arsenal. And they make a handful of really good arguments. So I thought we could talk about that today. And I mean, really, who better than you, General Chun, to join us to have this discussion? So since you're our guest, you know, we're a polite group here most of the time. Of course, welcome back to Curtis and Jim. But since you're our guest, you've read the article and you've lived this, and you know, you spent your entire career in the South Korean Army. And so you know North Korea and the challenge it presents better than anyone. As you look at this problem, and as you look at sort of the pros and cons of South Korea going nuclear. How do you sort of come down on that issue?
So I want to make clear that it's not because we don't trust the United States. I think it's because we don't trust how humans act. Not only, you know, our friends, but our adversaries and our enemies. And the North Koreans are constantly trying to take away our freedoms. But for Koreans, it's not just North Korea. The Chinese, that's a broad statement, but the Chinese have been either ruling us or have had control over the Korean people for thousands of years, and we don't like it. So if the United States can see this as, why should you be burdened with having to challenge the Chinese over South Korea, is something that you might want to think about. So again, it's not because we don't trust the United States. We just don't trust how humans in general are, including ourselves. Secondly, I must admit, there's a lot that we South Koreans need to do. And it's not just about building the bomb. We can do that. But having the theoretical, the philosophical debate and the responsibility of having nuclear weapons, the safety issue of having nuclear weapons. Bizarre things can happen on the Korean Peninsula, as you saw just a couple of months ago. I'm referring to the martial law thing. So our leaders, our academia, our military, our security people, they must know what is related with having nuclear weapons, what kind of decisions, what kind of elements are needed. And that's where I think the United States can be proactive and help us build a very safe nuclear arsenal, and at the same time, make sure we understand what the price of using nuclear weapons is. And whenever I think of this, I'm reminded, gee, I wonder what the North Koreans are doing about this. So anyway, the second thing is, you know, help us rather than keep us away. I know we're limited on time, but when my sons were very young, they started smoking. And I could have, you know, cut down their allowance or something, but I didn't do that. I went to them and I said, okay, guys, you both know the dangers and harm of smoking. And they said, yes. And so I said, I'm going to increase your allowance so that you can buy the good stuff and not the bad stuff. And by doing that, I could monitor how much they were smoking. And, you know, one innuendo there, another innuendo here. And they stopped smoking. And because I held the purse, I knew how much they were spending on cigarettes. Now, they don't smoke anymore. But so rather than trying to say, no, you can't do that, maybe, yeah, go ahead, but this is how you need to do it, and measure it is another strategy. So the second point, again, is help us out rather than say no. Finally, I just want to stress that we Koreans have always benefited from our relationship with the United States. And the only reason that we are not going nuclear is because of the firm pledge by the American people and by your administrations that you would protect us, that you would sacrifice LA, New York, Washington, D.C. for Seoul. That is our understanding. That is what you have told us. If you're going to hold yourselves to that, fine. We don't need nuclear weapons. But if there's any wavering, if there's any second thought to that comment, then let us have our own weapons. It will be an extension of U.S. nuclear deterrence. Just think about it. South Korean nuclear weapons will never strike an American target. But they will not only protect us, but in a real shitty situation, like the United States being at war with the Big C, where do you think South Korean weapons will be going? Right where it yeah. should be. And finally, once we have a nuclear equilibrium with the North Koreans, we can talk to the North Koreans and say, okay, you know, F you, and we don't mind the Americans having an embassy in Pyongyang, you know. And when that happens, guess what? You know, all those North Korean ICBMs that are going to be pointed at LA, New York, and Washington, D.C., they might actually point the other way, because guess what? The North Koreans don't like the Chinese either. So it opens a diplomatic, it opens diplomatic options for the United States as well, which is not something that Kelly and Professor Kim talks about. But that's just what I want to say. Thank you.
Now, Jim, I think of the three of us, you've probably spent the most time in South Korea, because I think you've done a few tours there. So let me turn to you first. So as you read this article and as you've thought through, you know, nuclear weapons, we've had nuclear weapons there. Many people, some of our listeners may not know, but the United States used to have several thousand, mostly tactical nuclear weapons stationed in South Korea. So this is not a new phenomenon. It would be different in terms of, you know, who owns the weapons. But and you were a nuclear artilleryman and a FA-52. So how are you looking at this and thinking about this, Jim?
All right. Well, thank you. So for the first thing I would say, the last time we had General Chun here, by the way, he's a senior fellow with the NIDS, and we're really proud to have him as part of us. But the last time we had him on our cast, I actually went back and listened to that a day or two ago in preparation. And you gave a very somber discussion about being at the end, being in an area in Seoul that was, quite frankly, under direct attack almost at any minute where you stood. And that made you look at the world a little differently and may give a little more context to the way you view things. And I think that's a very important start to what happens. So, where we head with nuclear weapons. And yes, I've been in Korea when I was there. I was an engineer. I was not an artilleryman at the time, although I would say what I learned from the Korean people is the Korean people take this matter of North Korea's aggression towards South Korea extremely, extremely to heart. And it's a really important part of the culture and of what happens in Korea. So when I read the article, I put that in my mind as I read through it and said, if I was in South Korea as a South Korean, how would I feel about this aggression toward me? And there are a couple of things I want to point out. One is, what I think is a red herring, and without getting into many details, but you look at safety and security, or what's referred to as surety for nuclear weapons. South Korea has a government system, a trusted system. We're not looking at some country that's going to be selling weapons on the black market or anything else of that kind of thing. That's a non-issue. But I'll even take the safety issues, although there's a lot in our sharing that we can do. But even in countries that haven't put safety as a major concern, I'll take North Korea. I'll take we can look at Iran. We can look at the early Russian nuclear weapon development programs. Where were the big accidents that everyone's worrying about? They don't happen because they are somewhat self-limiting, because, an accident in your backyard is an accident in your backyard. And so the fact that you would take it seriously and apply, general principles of engineering and design and development that would ensure that those weapons are safe is really important. But it's already been done by many countries without our input. And I could trust the engineering and science and technology of a South Korea to do that. That's been shown many times. And I think that's one of the things that when we get into this discussion from both ends, so, you know, South Korea's view of they are, you know, at the end of the, you know, the steely end or the in the sights of North Korea and China. And then the other side of what can you do and what can and you have trust in doing if you went this route. And I think both of those are in place at this time, you know, 2025 now. You know, there may have been a time when that was not true, but I don't think that time is true right now. That's, a, you know, my personal opinion, having been there and having looked at this problem from sort of a technological standpoint. But I do, from a tactical standpoint, I'd be interested in your comments. When we talk about implementation of the nuclear weapons, you know, and I'm probably the worst to say this because I always dress at people when I say tactical nuclear weapons versus strategic weapons. My view is they're all strategic weapons. They're all political weapons. However, from a standpoint of their operational plans, and again, I don't want to get into details, but would you see South Korea developing a technology of more tactical use, similar to what, you know, Russia looks at their, quote, tactical nuclear weapons in terms of, you know, close support, you know, cross the border? Are we looking at, you know, development, or would you see the development of, you know, long range missiles that would be carrying nuclear weapons? You know, just to sort of give us an idea of where that would be heading, in your opinion.
Yeah, so we have the missiles right now. So, and I would say we don't go for intercontinental, but intermediate range is what our current capability is. And of course, there are cruise missiles as well. As the article refers to, submarines, although ours is conventional, they're pretty good. And I'm skeptical about Korea needing nuclear-powered submarines anyway, but the submarine technology is there. Our newest version of the submarines have ballistic missile launch capability. So those are the kinds of delivery systems that we already have, and we're pretty close to it. Although we have not gone to this level of discussion, I don't think we need a 50 megaton, you know, warhead.
Yeah.
But we do need options. So a small 2 kiloton warhead and maybe a 10 kiloton warhead is something that we would need. A 1 kiloton just to react to a North Korean tactical use. And I agree with you, Jim, about the difference between tactical and strategic. If you use a small weapon on a strategic target, that's strategic to me. I mean, and I won't go into that. But but if the North Koreans, we have to have some sort of, you know, balance and proportionality. So just for that case, I think, you know, 1 kiloton and then maybe a maximum of 10 kilotons is probably what we would need. But I got to tell you, there's a really, really robust discussion on the Korean side here. And my message to them is, okay, fine. You know, I agree that we need nuclear weapons, but not at the cost of the alliance with the United States. So the article captures that. It captures the fact that the only thing that's holding us back is the United States. And guys like me are trying to make sure that there is no rift because of this issue. But it's not easy. And I got some crazy people here too. So they want to go nuclear no matter what. And so I think that's not the right thing. Another concern for me is once we do have nuclear weapons, I am absolutely sure that there will be some knuckleheads who say, oh, since we have this great weapon, we won't need a large army. How about we go down to 10,000, you know? And that's something that I'm really worried about. And that's what I'm already anticipating and fighting against.
Now, as I read this article, and Curtis, I think you might have sort of read it the same way, in that, in the sense that, you know, they make the argument that, you know, Donald Trump will be isolationist and transactional. And as I read the article, I thought their characterization of Donald Trump and his foreign policy was probably wrong, in the sense that, you know, if, as we've heard the last few days, we can probably expect here soon after inauguration that Canada will become the 51st state. Greenland will become part of the United States. We're going to take back the Panama Canal. And I want to be the first one to offer South Korea statehood. You can become the 52nd state.
Oh my God.
So, you know, I don't know how, you know, maybe the fact that, you know, this article came out just weeks before President Trump announced that Canada would be the 51st state. Maybe that's why they got it wrong. But
all right, you're taking my limited time with this frivolity. Let me say this. First of all, General, thank you so much for being here. It's always fantastic to have you. I look at this in a couple different ways, and I appreciate your perspective, Adam, on the author's perspective on soon to be President Trump 2.0. I think this really comes down to trust, stability, and cost. I think, first of all, we here at NIDS, and I'm sure you're very familiar with this, General Chum, but we have been advocating for South Korea's nuclear participation for a long time. And even when the Washington Declaration was released in April of 2023, even we knew that that was not going to sate the appetites, to provide the security. It was a band-aid to if you will, just tamp down these calls by the Biden administration. There is a fear, a geopolitical fear within the establishment here in the United States, whether they be Democrat or Republican, not the populace that might be the current Republican Party of Donald Trump. And that is that they don't want to do anything that lessens the strength of the non-proliferation regime, because that maintains a lot of dependence upon the United States, and that dependence creates influence. And so the United States seems to not be interested in respecting other nations, especially our allies. First world, capable, stable allies like South Korea, to make their own decisions as to what best services their security needs, what is in their national interests. Other states like, say, Australia, who are also very capable of becoming a nuclear state if they wanted to, are completely comfortable with the extended deterrence relationship with the United States, as is what apparently is Japan, since Japan didn't go nuclear when North Korea went nuclear. It won't go nuclear when South Korea goes nuclear, just as the authors of this article write. So I agree with all of that. I think there is a sense of instability. This idea that we can that a nuclear enlarging North Korea that is now going to be injected with Russian technology at a very rapid pace, I think is going to move this problem along a lot sooner and faster than we had ever thought it would be even 2 or 3 years ago. They're going to be more modern, they're going to be larger, and that is a threat to all of us. And so, and then when it comes down to cost, for all of the dispersions the authors cast upon President Trump, the one thing they probably can find some solace in is that he is going to look for ways to save money. And on one hand, if there are Koreans who would like to see fewer American troops on the peninsula, and perhaps there is a president that would like to see those costs be reduced, a nuclear-armed South Korea is probably the fastest way to achieving that. And so the last thing I'll say here is President Yoon, I think early in 24, came out publicly and said that he can't afford the economic punishment, the pariah status that South Korea would get should they seek their own nuclear weapons, that they could not take the economic devastation from his allies. And at that statement has always just really marked itself in my head, because it was a moment where an ally was more afraid of what we would do than they were afraid of what North Korea would do. And that, I think, is not the sign of a healthy relationship between allies. And I think to your point, General, and to the author's points, I think a participating South Korea is completely not only plausible, but if we're going to do it, as you say, let's do it right. Let's make sure it's safe, secure, reliable. Let's make sure you have the kinds of systems you need, that they are secure, that they are able to be credible. And when the time comes, if for some reason some president, three presidents from now, decides, I am not going to trade San Francisco for Seoul, you have an option.
Well, let me sort of pile on to Curtis's comments. The article gave me there were two things I thought about, and I'm curious if you've thought through this. Number one is, you know, I think about China. China will definitely respond negatively. And sure. Is the way to get China not to respond negatively to build an arsenal that is, you know, it's a short range arsenal. It's perhaps gravity bombs on fighters. Perhaps it's artillery. Perhaps it's, you know, short range ballistic or cruise missiles, such that the Chinese can have the confidence that their cities, their major installations can't be targeted. Or do you build an arsenal that can target the Chinese, take the punishment, because the punishment will come for some short duration of time, because the Chinese do depend upon advanced manufacturing from South Korea. And then do you sort of just move beyond that? And then the other thing was, what about just having, you know, take sort of an Israeli approach and never admit that you have an arsenal? Build one that people sort of know that you have, but they can't really punish you because there's no real evidence that you actually have it. How has the Koreans been thinking through how they might do it?
Well, we don't care what the Chinese think. And besides, they had their chance during the six-party talks. And if they're willing to let the North Koreans have nuclear weapons, I don't think they have any right to tell us what to do about ours. But just to be polite, because we are a polite people, I think the Israeli mode would be the best. But then again, we Koreans are bad at keeping secrets, so let's see what happens. I just want to say this. Even if we had 100 nuclear warheads, like the article suggests, we would be dependent upon the United States for everything else, as we are right now. You know, that's why we are your most reliable ally, because we are so dependent upon you. Secondly, if Indonesia had nuclear weapons, let's see what happens in Australia.
Mm-hmm.
And again, I ask you, why should you put yourselves in a situation where LA, DC, and New York is endangered? You know, why put yourselves in that situation? And cost should be the last thing. You know, people tell us that it costs a lot of money to maintain nuclear weapons. I don't care how much we spend on having Americans on the Korean Peninsula. It's about $1 billion a year for us now. I don't care if it's $3 billion. Or $5 billion or $10 billion, like Mr. Trump says, because I know in the end it'll bring us more benefits. I just wish that Mr. Trump did not have to say that to us. We're not NATO. We already spend 2.7% on defense. So you don't have to bully us on that, or make it seem like it's bullying, because anti-American elements do exist in South Korea. These people are really weird. My only logical understanding is that they have some ties with the North Koreans, because they sound like North Koreans, they walk like North Koreans, and they quack like North Koreans. So they're ducky North Koreans. So these people, you know, don't give them ammunition saying, look, the U.S. president, he's bullying us. You don't have to do that. So don't give the other side ammunition.
Yeah, I appreciate that comment. One of the things that I didn't see in the article, and I was very curious what your thoughts are, because you're looking at your strategic location on the globe. And I agree that having a nuclear armed South Korea does one other thing for the United States, and that is if there was another global war, great power war, I would say if China were to go to war with the United States, that they would have to have their eyes on more places than just the United States. And I know that that puts South Korea in a worse position, but I don't think you're going to get out of it anyway. But I do wonder about the relationship with Japan and the relationship with Japan if South Korea were to develop nuclear weapons and where that sits. And since you're in that region, what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, before I answer that, if the notion of South Korea having nuclear weapons scares you, just imagine how scary it must be to the Chinese. Just think about that. And going to your question about the Japanese, I personally I'm not concerned that Japan will have an arsenal, because it'll be the end of the earth if they're going to use it on us. And besides, there's this very anti-nuclear weapon, anti-war sentiment in Japan that will inhibit them from going on this track. Maybe South Korea having nuclear weapons might be a catalyst for Japanese nuclear program, which I don't think is a threat to South Korea. And maybe it might go the other way, saying that the Japanese will say, well, since another friend, I won't call ourselves allies yet, has a nuclear weapons, maybe we don't need our own, might be something that the Japanese might think. But it's not just Japan, is it? You know, if South Korea goes that way, I think the United States needs to be very careful in how you approach this situation, because it does have the potential for a ripple effect, which is Japan and Taiwan. Now, if Taiwan were to go nuclear, the Chinese would probably freak out. And so I think how you approach this, why should you even say, you know, you're supporting this, rather than we can do some, what we Koreans would do is manage sparring. You know, I put a right jab, you block, and you put a right jab, I block, but it's all make-believe. And everybody knows that in the end, we both come out as winners.
Yeah, I'd like to add real quick as we're wrapping things up, you know, this idea that even if South Korea were just to openly discuss this idea, just to see how the Chinese would react, that one counter offer to them would be is if you don't want us to gain nuclear weapons, you need to disarm the North. And if they are the most influential to the North, and they seem to be tolerant of the North being armed, if they're not going to be tolerant of the South being armed, then their only other option is to disarm the North and remove the reason for you. And that might have a benefit as well. So, you know, there's lots of ideas about this. You know, back in Trump's first term, he mentioned once that perhaps he would let Japan become a nuclear power. And, you know, when you think about, I mean, I personally believe the Chinese don't fear the Americans. But I believe they would fear a nuclear-armed Japan, given their history. And so if you really want to negotiate a better deal with the Chinese, you know, leveraging the potential of Japan, the appetites of South Korea with regard to nuclear weapons against Chinese positions geopolitically, I think, has some value there. But America tends to want to just eschew that because that would be counter to this non-proliferation institution that we have been nurturing for decades. That has all it has done is ensured, you know, 8 to 9 nuclear powers in the world and potentially more in the future. And it has created, I think, a lot of requirement. You know, Kissinger once said that it was unfair of NATO, right, to ask us to do something that we are probably not willing to do. Yet we play this game. And so I just think it's unfair not to allow our closest, most trusting, loyal allies, for lack of a better description, who are most capable to deny them anything they would like to have to ensure their own security. And if it means less a requirement of us, I'm not sure that's necessarily a bad thing.
All right. Well, unfortunately, we're out of time. You know, that's the downside to keeping our podcast at, you know, short commutes in D.C. or normal commutes everywhere else in the country. But, you know, we try to keep it at a half hour. So, General Chun, thanks for joining us. It was great to have you. Great to have your inputs.
Thank you.
And thanks to Curtis and Jim, as always. It's always a great discussion. You know, the only thing I was going to suggest was that South Korea, Taiwan, and Japan should join with Ukraine, do all of the development work, fund the development work in Ukraine, and then everybody gets part of the program and everybody arms up. And then the Russians and the Chinese and the North Koreans will, you know, I can't really say it on air, but they'll have a definite problem on their hands. So that was my take on it. All great right. Idea. Well,
yeah, great idea. Sounds like a good episode for Star Trek. winding us back to the beginning. Before Adam closes out, I just want to say a sincere thank you, Kamsahamnida, to General Chun. I really do appreciate you being a part of us and all you do and your frank comments. It really helps us and I think helps our nation understand the situation you're in. And that's what we want to be able to do. So thank you.
Thank you.
Adam?
All right. And thanks to you, the listeners, for joining us on this episode of the NIDS View. And remember, check us out at Global Security Review. Oh, we now have a Rumble channel. You can watch videos and make donations, anything you want. And if Rumble goes well, we may start adding some live programming there. Curtis and I were talking about doing Scotch and Strategy on Rumble. That seemed like a great idea to me. So check us, you know, we've got Curtis keeps the Twitter feed up. He puts great articles and comments on it every day. So, you know, follow us on Twitter, read Global Security Review, listen to our podcast. We've got live events. I think, you know, we have about 2 live events a month. So make sure you're listening to the HUSI events. Yeah, there's lots going on at the National Institute for Deterrence Studies. So keep listening. Thanks to you, the listeners. And as always, we want to remind you to think deterrence.
Thank you for listening to the NIDS View. This show is produced under the NIDS Podcasting Network, a division of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies. NIDS is a 501(c)(3) organization dependent upon donations to provide this podcast and bring about awareness of the peacekeeping value of U.S. strength and our national deterrence. You can catch all of our podcasts or provide feedback at thinkdeterrence.com. I would like to thank our producer, Kimberly Charrington,
our sponsors, and all the fantastic members of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies for making this podcast possible. Stay tuned next week for another exciting and informative The NIDS View.